My name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm real privileged and humbled to speak here tonight. I really appreciate the opportunity. I've just gotten to know James. I moved in next door to him, over right next to his office, over off of Executive Drive, and Ed Burns was in there putting some wiring in for me. And Ed says, "Oh, I know exactly where he's at. James is over there." And he told me a little bit about James and a couple of the guys that were over there, and it was really funny because I went and saw James and said, well, how do you know Ed? Well, I knew him through this, knew him through that. And he goes, well, how do you know Ed? I said, I'm friends of Bill Wilson. He goes, oh, okay, you know. There was an Englishman, a Frenchman, and an alcoholic, and they landed on this sacred island. The natives come out. They says, look, this is sacred ground. You shouldn't have landed here. The punishment is death. But before we kill you, we just want to tell you that we're going to use your skin for our canoes, and we're going to boil your bodies in oil. We're going to skin you alive. I said, we'll give you one last wish. So they said to the Englishman, what would you like? He says, I'll take a knife. So he says, long live the queen, and he slits his throat. The Frenchman says, I'll take a knife too. And he says, vive la France, and he slits his throat. They came to the alcoholic and says, what's your last wish? And he says, I'd like a fork. And he said, a fork? He says, yes, I'd like a fork. So they gave him a fork, and he took it, and he says, to heck with your canoes! I knew my alcoholic friends would get that. Well, I was born at a very early age. I grew up, I had a normal family. We used to go to church on Sundays. We were a middle-class family. I was the oldest of five. Went to school. Everything was fine, you know. I grew up in a place where alcohol was all around. It was something that, you know, whether I was in the Boy Scouts or whether I was at a church function or wherever it was, you know, my parents and everyone drank freely and openly. And so it was very normal for me to see a lot of drinking. I can remember my first drink. I was about 5 years old, and my dad was having a martini. And I asked him if I could have a sip, and he kind of smiled. I can see him just at that point, and he just handed and said, sure, yeah, go ahead and take a drink. And I took a drink, and I liked it. And I took a really big drink, and he was just amazed. He said, give me that back, you know. And that was at 5 years old. In third grade, I can remember they used to do the Iowa Basics test. Does anyone ever do the Iowa Basics? And I can remember the teachers would tell us that this doesn't affect your grade. So don't worry about what you get. This doesn't affect your grade. And my friends and I thought, well, if this doesn't affect our grade, they'll just draw some neat designs in that. So we did that every year. And my parents would look at me and say, oh, Jim, what's wrong? You know, I mean, you got like a 19 on your English. And they would use that to place you in the next class the next year. So I was always placed in the dumb classes starting off. They said, there's something wrong because I couldn't read. I had dyslexia real bad. When I started coming to the meetings and starting sobering up, I never knew I had dyslexia. I would always question, is there really a dog? No, I'm just kidding. I had a really tough time reading. I couldn't read out loud. I would mix letters around. I just couldn't read. And when I started sobering up and we would go around the meetings, I would be horrified of just reading because I couldn't read. And my dad told me, he says, hey, did you ever do better on that dyslexia? And I said, I had dyslexia? He says, yeah, that's why you have trouble reading. And I thought, nice of you to tell me, you know, going through high school and grade school and all that with that. I can remember my first drunk. When I first got drunk, I was 12 years old. I was with a dive shop, and they used to do the big boat show, and they'd have a 9,000-gallon tank, and we would scuba dive. All the kids would scuba dive in this tank. And I was taking scuba diving lessons, and we went back to the dive shop afterwards, and there was a rum and coke that they passed around. And I thought that thing was just delicious. I got a warm feeling inside, and I just loved it. I kept watching that thing go down, you know, because everyone was drinking it, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, I got my fair share. The bowling alley where we're getting the Cokes next door was closing, you know, and I just kept saying, you know, we need to go over there and get another Coke, you know, for this rum, because we're almost out of Coke. And I just had no concept that my dad was coming to get me soon, and I was 12 and drinking, having a good buzz. I started drinking. I guess the first time I really heavily drank was when I was 13 years old. That same dive shop took a bunch of kids on a trip to the Bahamas, and we went scuba diving, and it was partying, drinking like a fish. And it's that time where I had other friends introduce me to some other drugs, marijuana, which I never really liked it. Alcohol was my drug of choice. That didn't stop me from saying no when it came around, but the trip to the Bahamas, I felt like I'd lost my innocence. You know, I felt like, gosh, I kind of wish Mom and Dad were here because they would keep me from this. But, you know, I just went on and drank with everyone else and drank quite a bit. As I started high school, it became a normal ritual that every weekend you would go out and tie one on. You'd go out and get drunk. It was difficult freshman year to get the booze. But we'd figured it out, and it got easier and easier every year to go out and get the alcohol. At about 16 years old, I figured out I could get a job, and I went to the restaurant business, busing tables. And it's a good thing because there's a lot of people who drank heavily in the restaurant business, and I started learning about partying and getting a little more alcohol and different kinds of alcohol. I remember going from high school to grade school, or grade school to high school. That would kind of be backwards, wouldn't it? I can remember I was always placed, because of my dyslexia, in the slower classes, and the high school that I wanted to go to was in Kansas City. It was Rockhurst High School. It would be like DeSchmidt here. It was a Jesuit high school. And they had an entrance exam to get in, and I was told by my teachers, who really encouraged me, that they said, there's no way you're going to get in there, Jim. You're just not smart enough. Well, I figured out that they were advancing me or putting me in these classes because I was filling out the Iowa Basics exams from about third to fifth grade and just kind of making designs on there. But I started applying myself, and I had to take this entrance exam, and I got a 98% in the mathematics and got advanced placement in all the mathematics and science classes. So I felt smarter. It felt like I had a second chance. As I worked in the restaurant business, I found later on I would start drinking on Sundays and then drinking on Thursdays. And so it became like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday drinking. And in high school, that was common for me to just be really tired and hungover in high school the next morning. And my teachers would say, you know, you can't sleep through class. You've got to wake up. And I'd say, well, you know, I'm working. It was kind of a challenge for me at the time. At 16 years old, Mom had decided that she was an adult child of an alcoholic, and she started going to Al-Anon. And she had a lot of friends who were going to Al-Anon. And my brothers and father and everyone and I, we all drank. We were happy about our drinking. We had a good time about our drinking. Mom was going to ruin it now with her darn Al-Anon. I would come home, and she would say, how much did you have to drink, Jimmy? And I would say, two, just barely standing up. And she'd look at me like, oh, right. And I said, well, I had three. And I come to find out that that's a standard alcoholic answer. You know, I only had two. And as she went into this Al-Anon, it caused a lot of friction in our family. And our family was starting to crumble apart. Mom and Dad got separated about 16 years old. And I had some resentments. It was very stressful around my house. I can remember a friend telling me that, he says, you know, for a 16-year-old, Jim, you are too intense. You need to go out with some of your friends and have a few beers, lighten up. And I found that alcohol was a great, great reliever of stress. And so now I had another tool to relieve my stress. But I would drink, you know, whether it was up, whether it was down, whether it was stressed, whether, you know, it didn't matter. I was drinking. I remember going to Alateen, and in the Alateen it was different because how I'm involved in Alateen is my mom's parents were alcoholics, so that would make my grandparents alcoholics. And we would go around the meetings, and somebody would be talking about, you know, getting beat with a wrench for spilling a can of paint, you know, and about their dad and, you know, really tough things. And you'd get to you and say, yeah, my grandparents are alcoholics. And they'd look at you like, what? You know, why are you here? And so that didn't fare too well. Mom thought it was a good idea that the whole family would go through a month-long program of what alcoholism does for the family, you know. So we had to, every single night for 3 hours, go to these stupid meetings. I hated them. But it taught me a lot about alcoholism, and it taught me a lot and planted a lot of seeds that would later I would use to where I would learn that I had a problem. As I got to be a senior in high school, it was party time. I was partying pretty heavy. And, you know, in the summer, it was drinking every night. And on the weekends, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I mean, I would drink all the time, you know, senior in high school. I decided that, my friend and I decided that after we graduated, we would go to Europe. And I can remember, it was like the day before I was going to Europe, and I had my plane ticket, and I had my Eurail pass, and I had about $50 in my pocket, and we were going to be gone for a month. I don't know how I got the money, but I got enough money to go over there. But it was funny because my dad kept saying, there's no way you can make it to Europe. There's no way. You're just not going. Forget it. And for me, I just don't tell me I can't do something, you know, because I'm going to prove you wrong and I'm going to do it. And we went over there, and there's no drinking age in Europe, which is a good thing, and no speed limit. That was a fun time. I backpacked through Europe. We stayed in youth hostels for $5 a night. It was 1985, and for every dollar that we had, it was like we had $2 over there. We went out, and we would have a big dinner in Italy with appetizers and steaks and wine and the whole nine yards, and it'd be about $8 a person. And it was just great because we could really drink a lot over there. And I found in Germany the booze was a little bit cheaper. So we closed down the Hofbräuhaus and had the tour of Europe and started peeking out at my drinking. I went to college at MU. At the time, Rolling Stone magazine had the top 10 party schools. And we looked on that list, and MU, I thought, for certain, had to be in that top 10. It was one of the top party schools. And as we looked through that top 10 list of party schools, it did not have MU in the top 10. It had it in the footnote. It says, MU is in a completely separate category. It doesn't belong in the top 10. There was a party every single night there. It was the biggest party that I'd had, and I had that party for about a year and a half, and I got my doctorate in drugs and alcoholism in just a year and a half. It was a pretty big party, and I can remember some of the insanity that I had when I was down there. I went down there and got a job, and I was a UMPID, University of Missouri Police Department, so we'd park the cars and do all the concerts and things like that. There was a shift that I was supposed to show up for the same night as a really good party that I wanted to go to. And I chose to go to the party, and they chose to fire me. And I remember getting my last paycheck, and I thought, this has got to last me for a while. What should I do with this last paycheck? It was probably about $300 or $400, and I thought, I got to do something wise with this because I'm not going to have any money for a while. So I went and cashed it, went to the liquor store, spent every penny I could on the cheapest booze I could, and I opened a bar in my room. And I thought, well, you know, they'll have this bar, people come up to my room, and I'll mix them a cocktail and make a little money, you know, keep my flow going for a while. And unfortunately, I was the best customer, and I didn't pay. Well, after college, I went back to the restaurant business and started waiting tables. I was 20 years old, and I'm in the restaurant, and I'm waiting tables, and I would make some pretty good money in tips. It was a nicer restaurant, and I was living at home with my dad and my brothers, and I would work all night, and I'd make $100 in tips, and I'd come home, and I'd only have about $20 in my pocket. And I would sit at the bar all night. You know, I'd get off and we'd go sit at the bar, at the restaurant. And I would spend all my money at the restaurant. And I couldn't figure out, you know, why couldn't I get out of the house? You know, why couldn't I buy a car? You know, all my money kept going to alcohol. Well, eventually I was sitting at the bar, and there were a couple other waiters and waitresses who knew that I was only 20 years old, and they told management one day that I was not 21. And they asked to see my license, and I didn't have it. And they said, are you 21? And I said, no. They said, well, we got to fire you. I said, yeah, but I'm a good waiter. And it's you know, you don't understand, you know. You don't understand what risk you're putting us in. And so I was all bummed out, and I decided to go to a different restaurant and get a job down on the plaza in Kansas City. It's a restaurant called Harry Starker's. I worked at that restaurant and was introduced to a whole world, another world that I hadn't seen. It was called cocaine. And I liked that drug because I could drink a lot more when I wanted to, because I could use this new tool that I found, cocaine, but it was expensive. And I found that I had a car now, but I couldn't pay the taxes on the car to get license plates. So I drove my car for 1.5 years without license plates. 1.5 years. That was insane. At that restaurant, it was the top 50 wine list in the world, and I started studying up on wine, and I got to be the head wine steward there. I thought that was pretty neat because I got to drink on the job. And I got to get a buzz on the job. And it was so cool because I could get drunk on the job and get paid for it. What kind of, I mean, it was a wonderful job. I then got a job at a liquor store. And I was, because I knew so much about wine, I was working at the liquor store. I did a little bit of bartending. So I'm the wine steward, I'm working at a liquor store, and I'm doing a little bartending. And I remember telling my dad that I wanted to own a restaurant and bar and a liquor store. And he says, Jim, that's the dream of every alcoholic. I didn't take too kindly to that because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And who's he to tell me that I have a drinking problem? Looking back, it was something that I enjoyed doing. You know, I enjoyed wine, I enjoyed getting drunk, and it was a little insane. The performance that I had as a waiter and wine steward kind of slacked off. I kept forgetting to turn in the money at the end of the night. They had a little bit of a problem with that. And after about the millionth time of forgetting to turn in the money, I got fired. And that wasn't good because I didn't have any money and I was behind on my rent. So I called my buddy, my good drinking buddy, and he hired me to come out and work for $5 an hour as a bouncer at this bar. I couldn't afford to keep the apartment, so I moved in with him and his wife and kids. When I moved out there, I didn't make much money, but he could drive me to work. I made $5 an hour, and because he was the general manager, we drank for free. So had my alcohol taken care of. Well, he and I drank quite a bit, and eventually he decided he got hired at another place downtown in Kansas City and asked me to come with him, so I went down there with him, and it was kind of a bar and grill, and I was used to waiting tables at a really nice restaurant, and I couldn't even manage waiting at this bar and grill, but I had free booze down there, and I felt horrible. You know, I just didn't like working down there because it's like all my friends were graduating college, and here I am at this bar and grill as a waiter, and my self-esteem was just really low. Of course, I didn't know that I had a drinking problem, not from the lack of mom telling me I had a drinking problem and always asking me about my drinking, but I just, you know, my perception was off. So my friend knew that I knew a little bit about computers, and he asked me to write a program, an accounting program for the bar and grill. And so that's what I did. And I worked on this program and wrote this program and was really proud of what I was doing. But eventually, when I finished the program, it was done and they didn't need me anymore. And I finished that program. My brother called me up and said, "Well, I'm out here selling cars. These Hyundais had just come out." And he says, "You got to come out because everyone's buying them. It's the cheapest car out there." So I thought, well, I'll go out and sell some of these Hyundais. And I went out there, and he took me out and told me how to, you know, show somebody a car and what to do and how to sell them and how to close the deal. And it was Friday night. I went to work Thursday. He trained me on Friday. Friday night, he's in there trying to close a deal. Everyone has gone home for the night, and everyone was coming in that night looking at cars because there were no salesmen around. I'm just sitting out in the lot waiting for my brother, and I'd say, "Here, ask for me when you come back. Ask for me when you come back." So the next day, I sold 4 cars, and I thought, I am this awesome salesman now. I liked it. I found that people in the car business drank a lot. I like that. I continued drinking like a fish there, and I can remember I was making more money selling cars, but I didn't have any money. I'd moved back in with Dad, and there was a lot of friction at home, and he would call me an alcoholic, and I didn't really like that. I was there at the car dealership, and I kept getting back together with my old buddy who was the manager of this bar and grill, and we would go out drinking. As we'd go out drinking and everything, we'd be partying and having a good time, and I would come in every night at about 3 in the morning. I can remember we were at the bar, Clancy's in Kansas City, and we're sitting there. He had left his wife and was living with his girlfriend, and she was the case study for Fatal Attraction, that movie. Oh, it was pretty bad. But we're sitting at the bar, and it's about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he looks at me and he says, "Jim, I think I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "You know, I think I am one too." And all those meetings and AA classes and everything that we went back to, I was like, "Oh, now I probably got to go to a meeting." So we decided we were going to go to a meeting together. Well, he says, "I'll be right back." Went up, went to the bathroom, but he didn't come back. He just left. You know, so I'm sitting there, and I got a pitcher of beer, and I'm drinking the beer, and I'm thinking about this conversation we just had, and I got a pretty good buzz going on, and I'm thinking, you know, I've drank many nights before and come to this conclusion, but I have never done anything about it. I sober up the next day and blow it off. I said, "By golly, I'm going to do something about it tonight." So at about 2 in the morning, I picked up the phone and called my mom. And I said, "Mom, I think I have a drinking problem." She says, "Where are you?" I said, "At a bar." She said, do I need to come get you?" And I said, "No, I'm fine." She goes, "Well, you're drunk at a bar. How are you going to drive home?" I said, "Mom, I'm used to it. I'm pretty good at it. In fact, be careful tonight because this is amateur night." I said, I'm used to it. And she says, "Well, call me when you get home." So I got a six-pack. You know, I figured I'm going to quit, so I might as well tie a good one on tonight. I went home, had a beer, picked up the phone, called my mom back, said I'm home, and she said, okay, that's good. I'll call you tomorrow. So she calls me tomorrow at work, and she says, Jimmy, do you remember calling me last night? There was my opportunity to get out of that, but I said, yeah, I remember. She said, do you remember what you said? I said, yeah, I remember. And she says, do you want to talk to somebody? And I said, well, who? And she gave me a name of two people. One of them I didn't know, the other one I did know. And I said, yeah, I'll talk to him. And so she said, here's his number. You call him up. So I called him up. And my mom had been, you know, razzing me and praying for me for many years and watched me just go through all sorts of drinking and drugging and lots of problems. And she was so excited that I've come to this reality. And so I called this gentleman, Tom, and I said, Tom, I think I have a drinking problem. And I'm not sure. He said, well, let's get together and talk about it. So Tom and I got together at Tom's place, and we spent 3 hours talking. And he says, why do you think you have a drinking problem? And I said, well, you know, I drink too much. I can't, you know, I drink every night. I don't have any money. I'm frustrated with how things are going. My life's unmanageable and everything else. And I'm waiting, you know, I want him to, after I give him all this information, tell me, am I an alcoholic? I said, am I an alcoholic? And he said, well, I don't know. She says, what do you think? I said, I don't know. I'm asking you, am I an alcoholic? You're the expert. And he says, you know, that's a determination you're going to have to come to by yourself. I said, well, how would I find out if I'm an alcoholic? He says, just go out and try some controlled drinking. I said, what do you mean? He says, for you, Jim, what I'd recommend doing is go out and have 3 drinks a day for the next 2 months. He says, you can't skip a day. You have to have 3 drinks every day for 2 months. You can have one in the morning, you can have one in the afternoon, you can have one in the evening. You can drink them all together. And he said, they're not the beers at Kelly's that are this big. It's a 12-ounce beer. It's an 8-ounce glass of wine. It's one shot of whiskey. He says, but just have 3 a day. I left there and thought, I am not an alcoholic. Because no one in their right mind would suggest I do any controlled drinking. And so I was just talking to my mom about this. I called her up and she goes, well, how did your meeting go? What happened? I said, well, Tom doesn't know if I'm an alcoholic and I don't know if I'm one either, but he said to just try having 3 drinks a day for 2 months. And she wasn't real happy with that because, you know, she was hoping that I would go to a meeting or something. But her sponsor in Al-Anon says, you know, you got to let go. You got to let go and let God. And so I remember driving home. I was going to go to a bar that night, but I thought, nah, probably not. I've been talking about a drinking problem for the last 3 hours. I probably shouldn't go to a bar that night. But I remember the next night, I went out on a date with my brother, and we're sitting there at the restaurant, and I'm thinking, okay, 3 drinks. You can do this, just 3 drinks. So I'm thinking, you know, there's a conversation going on. I'm just totally focused on the 3 drinks, and I'm thinking, okay, what should I have? I've got a really, you know, I've only got 3, so I thought, what's going to give me the biggest buzz? They said, don't mix your drinks. By gosh, I'm going to mix them. I'm going to have beer, wine, and hard liquor. So I thought I'd start off with some scotch and soda and had that. And I'm nursing this, and I'm thinking I only got 2 more left. And that guy probably didn't even put a full shot in this one, you know. Then I thought, well, I'll have an import beer because an import beer is going to have more alcohol in it. So I had a Heineken, and I'm thinking, Heineken, I got half a beer left, I only get 1 more drink. Okay, and then I'm thinking, what's the next drink? I'm thinking, okay, Chardonnay, because that's going to have the most alcohol in it. So I have a glass of Chardonnay, and I'm, you know, I can't remember any of the conversation, anything that we talked about. I was just focused on the drinks that I could have. I did it. I made it. I went to sleep. No drinking problem. I had my 3. I can do this. it didn't dawn on me that the sick thinking about, you know, what I was thinking about at the time. But the next night I went out, and it was Friday night, and I remember going to an Al-Anon meeting with my friend. Afterwards, we decided to go to my favorite bar, Clancy's, again. And I thought, well, I can have three drinks, but I'm an economical, frugal guy, so I thought, you know, we'll have a pitcher. As I'm drinking the pitcher, I'm thinking, these really aren't 12-ounce glasses. These are more like 10-ounce glasses. And I'm thinking, I could probably have four. You know, I'm calculating the ounces and everything else, and the waitress comes by and says, would you like another pitcher? And I'm thinking, Friday's not a good night to quit anything. Monday, I'll start it on Monday. So that night and Saturday night, I really, really got rip-roaring drunk. By the end of next week, I had drank my three drinks a day for 2 months and just condensed it in a week's period. I hadn't had cocaine in 9 months, and I was back on that. I thought, you know, I got a problem. So I called this Tom guy back, and I said, Tom, I did my three drinks a day. I just did them in 2 weeks and not 2 months. Okay. He says, do you want to go to an AA meeting? I said, yeah, that would be pretty good. He says, why don't you come over here, meet me over here. We'll go over together, and we'll go to a meeting. So as we're driving over there, I said, Tom, I'm still not convinced I'm an alcoholic. I said, when they go around the meeting, so I know this, they'll say, hi, my name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic, and I don't want to say that because I don't know. I know that's the kiss of death. As soon as I say that, I've got to quit drinking. He says, tell them you're just looking at the program. I said, okay, I can live with that. So I said, goes around, my turn. Hi, my name's Jim. I'm just looking at the program. And they said, oh, is this your first meeting? I said, yes. And this group of people stood up and says, we have a special meeting for you in the back. And it was a first step meeting. And they all went around and told me their story, and I was amazed at the similarities. I thought, I had this glimpse that I could do this. These people weren't that strange. I was picturing that alcoholic as somebody, you know, I was picturing I'd be in a group of people, homeless people, that just came off. They weren't normal like me. I can remember that first step meeting going around there, and I thought, okay, this is good. And it was like on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, and I went to another meeting, and I said, came around to me, hi, my name's Jim, I'm just looking at the program. I can remember going to a couple meetings, and then I went a whole week without drinking, and Saturday night came, and I thought, there's no way I can be an alcoholic, because I went a whole week without drinking. So I'm going to have a couple beers on Saturday, but just a few. 3 a.m, closing down the bars. I'm just drinking, just power drinking at that time. Oh, man, I got a problem. So I'd go to a couple meetings, be sober for a week, say I'm not an alcoholic. Saturday night would come, and this would go on for a little bit. And I can remember saying, this is insane, you know. I can't keep doing this. So I can remember going to a meeting. I told my sponsor I was going to go to a meeting, and it was Tuesday night. He says, oh, don't go to that one. I said, why? It's just a meeting. There was a woman who was 140 years old, and she was the speaker that night, and her topic was the traditions and what they meant to her. And he said, I don't think you should go to that one. And by the end of that meeting that I went to, I was pulling out my hair saying, there's no way I can do this. Well, Wednesday came, and I went to a friend of mine's bachelor party. It was at a bar, just a bunch of guys getting together. And I can remember sitting there having club sodas and thinking, I can't do this, and got drunk. I picked up my car at the dealership, at the auto dealership, at about 3 a.m, and the guard wrote down that I picked up my car at 3 a.m. The next day at work, I thought, I've got to go to a meeting. And we worked from 9 to 9 there. 100% commission. I said I needed to get off an hour early tonight to go to an AA meeting. The general manager says, "You're not going." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Jim, I've let you out of here a couple times to go to a couple AA meetings, but," he says, "the guard wrote down that you picked up your car at 3 in the morning." He says, "I'm not going to have you go to your AA meetings and then come here and pick up your car at 3 in the morning." He says, "You're out getting toasted." He says, "You're not going to a meeting." I said, "I'm an alcoholic." That was the first time I admitted I was an alcoholic when I was sober. He says, "Well, if you want to go to a meeting, you're not going to have a job here." I didn't know he couldn't say that. I said, "Well, I'm going to go to a meeting." So I left and I went to a meeting. That was November 16th, 1989. I haven't had a drink since. When I started going to meetings, I picked this Tom to be my sponsor. He said, "Jim, what you need to do is you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And you need to go and have a little more serious attitude. You can't just go to a couple meetings and get drunk every weekend." So we had this talk, and I said, "I'm ready." So I started going to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I can remember the first 2 weeks that I was off alcohol, I was having the cold sweats and sweating all this out and having some challenges, and I didn't realize, you know, how much of a physical addiction that I had to alcohol. And it was pretty tough. I started going through, and I can remember my emotions were now coming to life, and I had suppressed them for so long. I felt like a Vulcan. You know, I felt like, you know, these are new to me and I don't know how to control these emotions. You know, I would be on a pink cloud and happy and just wonderful and music sounded great. And then the next day, I was ready to pull out all my hair and jump off a cliff because this fly was bothering me at night. It was up and down and up and down and up and down. And they started evening out and I kept going to meetings and everyone talked about working the steps. I had the first one down. I admitted I was an alcoholic. I took step one. I can remember I had incredible craving for sweets, too. I mean, sweets, because all the sugar in the alcohol, I just had this insatiable craving for sweets. I was talking to my sponsor, going through all these emotions. They're talking about the steps. I know I had my first one. I'm sitting in the meetings, I'm thinking, you know, my life would be so much better if, you know, I had a relationship, if I had money, if I didn't live at home with my dad, if all these other things would happen. It was frustrating because I looked at the car that I was driving and I can't give you, it was this beat up, wrecked Chevy Citation that had a million miles on it. Would die at every stoplight. You just couldn't keep the thing running. And I thought, you know, how can I attempt to go out on a date in this thing? You know, this is not going to work. So I thought, you know, I need to get another car. I don't have any credit. You know, the creditors are calling. I've got all these bills. They're wanting to repo my car. Or they already repoed my other car. They're wanting to... They wanted me to pay these fines that I'd picked up, you know, these tickets that I never paid. And I couldn't get my license all straightened out or couldn't get insurance, so I couldn't get a demo at the dealership. So I started working through that and saving money and going through that. I started working the steps. They talked about step three, turning my will and my life over to God. I'd gone to church before. I believed in God. I wasn't an atheist, but God was out there, and you know, He'd hit His thing, and I really didn't know how to turn my will over. So I did it the best I could at the time. I had my own prejudices about God. I thought about you know, I had my church background. I had seen preachers on the TV. I knew a few scriptures. I'd heard of a few miracles. I wasn't an atheist. God was too big to be put in a box. I couldn't describe who God was. I knew He was out there. I didn't know much about it. As I went to the meetings, I remember going through and starting to do the third step and say, okay, well, I've done it to the best of my ability. It's time to do a fourth step. And I sat down and I did a fourth step, and I did a couple pieces of paper, kind of read through the big book, read the 12 and 12, got a couple notes from somebody who went through treatment, said this is how to do a fourth step. And I did one kind of a pseudo fourth step and told my sponsor, now I'm ready to do my fifth step. And as I got done spilling my guts for an hour and a half with him, he looked at me and he says, Jim, you're not trying to do your fifth step, are you? I thought, that's why we set up this meeting. That's what I'm trying to do. He says, Jim, to do a fifth step, you got to do a fourth step. And I said, I did one. He says, where is it? I said, home. He says, how many pages did you do? And I said, well, I did probably three. He says, you haven't done your fourth step, Jim. You need to redo your fourth step. And you're not ready to do your fourth step because you really haven't done your third step. Oh, that set me off. I had a resentment that I had to work on for a while. Well, I kept going through the program and you know, kept moving on, working the steps, did my 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, going through them, making some amends, figuring out who I owed amends to. In my mind, I'd checked off I'd done that fourth step. I can remember getting to a year of sobriety. And the first year in sobriety, I met my wife. I met her in the first year. And it was really kind of divine providence how I met her, because there was a guy in AA who owned a car dealership, and I went to work for him, and my wife came out to buy a car. And I met her selling the car, so, you know, I had started this relationship. She'd never seen me drink. And it was a good thing. You know, it was a wonderful thing. You know, God brought us together, I thought. At a year, I felt like I was kind of let down because, you know, I was expecting, you know, after a year of sobriety, I could really, this is a big life-changing event. Now I should be able to walk on water or something, you know. And it was kind of a letdown. It's like, you know, we got to speak at a meeting in Kansas City. They had a Friday night meeting. It was your annual birthday. You got to get up and speak. And so I got to speak for my first time, and I was really proud. My mom came, and my girlfriend came, and, you know, everyone was there. And I can remember getting done, and I looked at my sponsor and said, well, what did you think? And he says, keep coming back, Jim. Keep coming back. He says, you told everyone what you did wrong. He says, Jim, you started off and you just keep coming back. So at the end of about a year, I decided to move to St. Louis. I got a job with Xerox, moved up here, came up here and started going to meetings over in Alton, found another sponsor, and that aching feeling about that four-step that I never really did, they kept talking about that dang four step again. And I told my sponsor, I said, well, I thought I did it, but I really don't. He says, let's just do it again, Jim. He says, and here's how you do it. He said, don't try and do the entire thing in one sitting. He says, do it until you're done, but keep coming back to it until you're done. And so that's what I did. And before long, I had pages written out, you know, of my inventory. And I had my resentments and everything else. And we did a fifth step that lasted for 5 hours. And he says, you did it. You can check that one off. You don't have to do it again. He says, Jim, you did a good fourth step. So I kept going to meetings, kept working the program. I got to a point where I was hungry. I was hungry for things of God. I was hungry for God. I was hungry for more spiritual things. I went to a meeting that was a Came to Believe meeting. It was a red book, and I would get involved in church and go to church and everything, and I would read. I would read about God. I was hungry for God. I wanted to have a better relationship with Him. And I left my job at Xerox and just was taking a new job, and I missed training, and another guy was going to do the training with me. He missed it too, and the next training was in Indianapolis. Going to Indianapolis and driving up there with him, this guy, he just glowed. He was happy. We talked about God on the way up there. I come to find out he used to be a Lutheran minister. He had, you know, just a wealth of knowledge. I really enjoyed talking to him. We talked a lot about God. And I talked to him about, you know, AA and, you know, the church that I was going to. And the church that I was going to, he could have, you know, had a lot of criticisms about it. He didn't. He pointed out all the good things. And I told him about AA, and he says, I know some people in AA, and it's a good program. And I really, really got along with him. And so as we were up there, 5 hours, 6 hours up, and 5 days there, and 4.5 hours back, and me telling him how I'd done this third step and, you know, really turned my will and my life over to God and everything, he looks at me and he says, Jim, what's keeping you from turning your will and your life over to God? And I thought, wait a minute, I just told him I'd done that, you know. I thought about that for a minute, and I said, you know, I guess to really let go and really surrender, I said, I'm afraid. I'm afraid. I'm scared to death that he'll send me off to be a Tibetan monk, and I'll have to go and pray all day, and I just, you know, I'm horrified that he would say, you know, I'd have to do this and leave my fiance and go become some missionary or something like that. And he just laughed. He just says, that's funny, because he says, that's what everyone thinks. He says, everyone thinks that. He says, there's a song that's called, Please Don't Send Me to Africa. He said, everyone thinks that. He says, but that's a wrong perception of God. He says, God's not going to, you know, unless you have a strong desire in your heart to do something like that, God's not going to want you to do that. So I thought, that makes sense. He says, why don't you really just turn your will over to God right now? I thought, okay. And so he and I went back to I had to pick up my mail. I was living at my grandfather's house and went back there. And he says, I want to just pray for you. I said, okay. And so he prayed for me. And I surrendered. I felt like a joy come over me and a smile, and I couldn't wipe the smile off my face. It was real. I thought, wow, this is pretty neat stuff. And I didn't really know how to react. I knew I was feeling something different, but I thought, wow, this is something here. And so I remember going home and telling my fiance at the time, you know, that I really did my third step, and I turned my will and my life over, and she's like, that's nice, good. So I had this great, great experience. I just kind of went on doing the things that I used to do, you know, going to the same church and going to meetings and reading a little bit, and Tom went away to a different employment. And as time went on, you know, all those things that I wanted, that first meeting, you know, to have a good job and move out of my house and have a relationship, all those things happened. I can remember it was about 2 years after that I'm moving into my new house. I've got a good job. My credit's okay. A lot of the promises in AA had come true. And I'm thinking, I should be really happy because, you know, I got a nice car now, and I got a house, and I got a relationship, and I got money in the bank, and I wasn't happy. And I kept thinking, you know, it's this God thing. I still don't have it. And so I kept thinking about this Tom guy, you know, to call him back, and I'd go to more meetings, and I'd do all sorts of things, and finally I picked up the phone and called him back and I said, Tom, I'm trying to build this relationship with God. Can you help me out? I don't know what to do. He said, yeah, I'll help you. And so Tom and I would get together at Hardee's every Tuesday morning for about 2 years. And he would just talk to me about God and some foundational things that I needed. And I built some of those foundations. I started building the relationship and started hanging around people who had that same relationship. And I just had a hunger and a pursuit for God. As time went on, I found that, you know, in AA, I found there's two parts of AA. There's a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then there's a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety is based upon me working this program. The fellowship reminds me that I need to work the program, but the program is working the steps and going through and working the steps. And I find that to this day, you know, I've got 17 years of sobriety. I still have challenges with people, places, and things, but not as much as I used to. Things are a lot better now. I can handle working with people a little bit better. They still frustrate me. I tell my friends, I said, I don't mind work, I just hate people. I don't. I like people, but they can frustrate you. I still have resentments that I have to deal with. My life today is quite a bit different than it was a few years ago. It's a lot better. I'm not there yet. I still need to work a program. Still make mistakes. My relationship with God, there is always room for improvement there. I still have my shortcomings. Not all of them have been removed, but some of the things that I noticed today that I didn't have back then is I have financial peace. I don't have to worry about the bill collectors. I don't have to worry about my credit rating. I don't have to worry about so many of the things that I used to have to worry about. And to me, there was nothing worse than having that financial stress. I hated that. I just hated financial stress. And today I'm at peace. I'm at peace whether I have $100 in the bank or whether I have $1 million in the bank. I've never had $1 million in the bank, but I'm at peace, you know, with whatever's there. Today, I have relationships that have depth to them. When I was drinking, my relationships were very superficial. I did not have any depth to a relationship. Now, my relationships, I can talk to my friends, I can talk to my wife, I can talk to many people and have depth in a relationship. My family life is better than I could have imagined. My wife and my kids have never seen me take a drink. In fact, driving over here tonight, my 10-year-old was saying, Dad, how can you be an alcoholic? You don't drink. I said, you didn't know me when. But I said, I'm just amazed at my family. My 10-year-old on Friday said, Dad, let's go to the coffee house. I want to work on my goals for next year. That's pretty amazing for a 10-year-old. My 7-year-old is somebody who just loves to spend time with their dad. And I love spending time with her. Both my kids are straight-A students. I'm extremely proud of them. My wife just gave me an incredible surprise birthday party for my 40th birthday. Truly surprising. I'm truly blessed to have a wife like her. My wife gives me wise counsel. I don't follow that counsel all the time, but she gives me wise counsel. She has a sixth sense about her. She can look at somebody that I'm going into business with and say, I don't know. I'm coming to trust that I don't know, because that sixth sense has some validity to it. She is a great partner. I'm not as baffled as I used to be. I know how to intuitively handle situations which used to baffle me. My attitude and my perception on life have changed. I don't think I'm as cynical as I once was. I think as you get older, I think you get a little more cynical. You don't like people as much. I wanted to close and leave you with this one thought. This is something that helps me out in dealing with people. I still have challenges dealing with people, but my cynicalness has gone away, and this is something that I often think about and often ponder. They say Mother Teresa had this up on her wall. This would kind of be a reminder of all the people who worked there at Calcutta with her. It says, people are unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Love them anyway. It says, if you do good, people will accuse you of selfishness or being selfish and ulterior motives. Do good anyway. If you are successful, you will win false friends and true enemies. Succeed anyway. The good you do will be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Honest and frankness make you vulnerable. Be honest and frank anyway. The biggest people with the biggest ideas can be shot down by the smallest people with the smallest minds. Think big anyway. People favor the underdogs, but follow only top dogs. Fight for the underdog anyway. And what you spend years building will be destroyed overnight. Build anyway. People really need help, but may attack you if you help them. Help people anyway. Give the world the best you've got, and you'll get kicked in the teeth. Give the world the best you got anyway. I want to thank James again for asking me to speak tonight, and it's really good seeing all these people and all these familiar faces. Thank you.